Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for January 27th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and in it, I have a new hacker word of the week, and I also have a monologue, as promised, on the subject of the hacker hero in literature and film. First, though, I thought in honor of Apple's launch event today for their latest product offering, I would offer my thoughts. Apologies if you're a reader of the blog. I know many of you are not, so this will be new to you. You may be one of the lucky few whose sweet spot is actually tickled by Apple's new device, or you may find yourself in the overwhelming majority that find the oversized iPhone wholly underwhelming. At least gauging from the various social networks, Twitter in particular, this seems to be the rough distribution of reactions to today's overhyped event. I won't bore you with a litany of technical issues that have elicited a mild meh from me about Apple's latest. The fact that the only means of distributing applications to the iPad discussed is the App Store eclipses any other complaint I might have. My love affair with my iPod Touch is enough of a dirty shame I have to bear. At least I can rationalize my purchase and use by focusing on the fact that I use it almost exclusively as a media player. I have vastly different expectations of a tablet, even one as stripped down as the iPad appears to be. How does Apple justify hobbling the device? Wireless carriers have begun offering comparably stripped-down computers, netbooks, that are still open to the end user installing whatever they like. I might concede that a single distribution channel makes the experience better, and Apple is clearly more about experience these days than any kind of substance. But why does the experience of some have to preclude the ability to exercise owner override? Would the App Store be any less used if power users could still install their own application bundles? If the arguments Apple makes about their captive channel really hold water, why not open the device to both and see if the market agrees? Allowing users to install simple application bundles like on a regular old Mac would be the shortest way to turn around much of the negative PR the approval process for the App Store has generated almost since day one. Usually, I'm skeptical of the need to actually protest the premiere of such a DRM-riddled gadget. The fact that this comes so close to a general-purpose computer, though, even a very low-powered one, makes even my hackles rise. If the hardware and OS has the potential to do anything, then I expect there should be no limit on how or why I take advantage of that by running the software I want from the source I want. The hacker word of the week comes from the jargon file maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Eye candy. Noun. From mainstream slang, ear candy. A display of some sort that's presented to losers to keep them distracted while the program performs necessary background tasks. Give them some eye candy while the back end slurps that blob into core. Reported as mainstream usage among players of graphics-heavy computer games. We're also told this term is mainstream slang for soft pornography, but that sense does not appear to be live among hackers. When I don't have enough bile for a rant and can't muster the necessary peace and serenity for an inner chapter, all that's left is for me to express my evil genius side and do a monologue. A listener and an acquaintance of mine, Dennis McDonald, when I put the call out for ideas to develop for features to share on the show, suggested that I do another sci-fi inspired rant. And while this isn't a rant, it is an idea that I've touched upon in a couple of my reviews of film and books that really is near and dear to my heart, so thought it would be an excellent idea to go ahead and try to dig into a bit more and unpack this notion of the hacker as a hero. It's easy, first and foremost, to look at the hacker as merely a trickster character. In digging into the mythology of Enki in particular, inspired by primarily my reading of Snow Crash many years ago, I realized that actually this characterization of Enki as a trickster is not complete. It's not entirely accurate. Understanding that inaccuracy, trying to better understand the actual attributes and characteristics of this Sumerian mythic character, of this Sumerian god, has driven kind of my thought process around looking at various representations of this sort of hacker archetype in literature and film. Definitely one of his attributes was mischief, but much more of his myth is actually wrapped up in technology and craft. Let me read you, a key section of the Wikipedia entry for Enki that I'll include as a link in the show notes. In character, Enki is not a jester or trickster god. He is never a cheat, and although fooled, he is not a fool. Enki uses his magic for the good of others when called upon to help either a deity or a human. Enki is always true to his own essence as a masculine nurturer. He is fundamentally a troubleshooter god and avoids or disarms those who bring conflict and death to the world. He is the mediator whose compassion and sense of humor breaks and disarms the wrath of his stern half-brother Enlil, the king of the gods. He is the challenger who tests the limits of Inanna in the myth of Enki and Inanna and the Meh, and then concedes graciously his defeat by the young goddess of love and war by strengthening the bonds between Eridu and her city of Uruk, so he becomes the empowerer of Inanna. Also think about, I think, probably a mythology that many of us are much more familiar with, that is the Titan Prometheus. I'll include a link to that as well if you want to familiarize yourself with the very thoughtful and lengthy entry on Wikipedia. He is a character that catalyzed change, so much so that he has become a metaphor, certainly in American culture and Western European culture, and maybe even more broadly, for change, usually change in the service of progress. Any sort of chaos that's wrapped up into that is chaos only for certain parties, to those that are incumbent or established powers. Humans were made much better off by Prometheus's actions at the expense of the gods. It is the gods who chained him down to be punished mercilessly as a consequence for disrupting the balance that favored them originally. Like Enki, though, he acts to restore or improve balance. The disruption, then, is merely either his means or a side effect of him undertaking that restoration. Considered more broadly, I think it's difficult to divorce the hacker archetype from social values. A thread that the Vandermeers in editing the steampunk anthology chased throughout that work, I'll include a link to that in the show notes, is how the hacker enables or responds to different social agenda. The introductory essay by Jess Nevins on the roots of steampunk starts with the Edisonades, a class of stories about madcap inventors bound very much up in manifest destiny and imperialism at the time that they were written. But these are very much in service of those urges to expansion that were prevalent at that time. Almost certainly this peeks through in the works of H.G. Wells, maybe even Jules Verne, who were contemporaries or precursors to the Edisonades. As Nevin traces the genre forward, he charts the reaction to this, the socially informed reaction to this almost gleeful, naive embrace of an inequitable social system that imperialist mandate, a more socially sophisticated, more nuanced view of class struggle, and even swinging to the other side to very often in the later generations of steampunk writing, seeing the inventors being in service of the undertrod, rather the twist characters in a Dickensian tale rather than Fagin, for instance. I wouldn't go so far as laying the roots of the social injustice in the Edisonades at the hacker's feet, per se. I would be more charitable and suggest that the zeal for invention clouds any further consideration and allows that background socioeconomic milieu to kind of seep in through the rest of the story. In later, more literary stories, like DeFilippo's steampunk trilogy, which is excerpted in the steampunk anthology. I'll include a link to DeFilippo's entire work if you're curious about that. He actually explores the conflict that can arise from this much more directly. So it's played forward in terms of kind of the social consciousness of his writing, but he's still looking at that sort of tension between a character that's so much in love with the technology and the craft, the hacker, that he still gets into these very awkward situations. DiFilippo is almost certainly informed by the reaction of the Edisonates. He's definitely in the modern canon of steampunk. In this later set of that genre, issues of class and social justice, as I said, are much more directly addressed. You also often see more evidence of the Promethean tale, technology and its inventors acting to redress imbalances, as I suggested when I made my reference to the Dickensian sort of archetype. I think the stories in the Steampunk Magazine, this is a fan-created series that comes out somewhat sporadically, but it's very lovingly crafted. I think those stories actually exemplify this better than anything else that I've read. They do the best job of exploring this particular aspect of a social consciousness. Because of my recent reading, steampunk just seems to be, of course, top of mind. That and technology is so central to the trope. It's an exploration of hands-on technology, of evident technology versus a reaction to black boxed kind of submerged technology that we deal with day in, day out. As Nevins points out about the Edisonates, the inventor is also often pulled into the foreground and made this critical character. I'm sure there are good examples of much of what I've talked about in this section on steampunk from other genres of fiction, but this is just something I'm familiar with from my own reading, can cite good examples. Cyberpunk is an excellent genre for exploring the experience of understanding systems. This is a huge motivation for real-world hackers, but it overlaps with the mythic trickster, or more accurately, as I've said, troubleshooter god. Knowledge begets culture, change, even progress. The pursuit of knowledge for its own sake is often what invites that chaos that earns many such mythic characters their reputation, undeserved, as tricksters. It doesn't change the first-hand experience of grokking a system, though. Stevenson is very accessible, in my opinion, as an author working in this vein. Snow Crash, in particular, was about the virtual system, the metaverse, and ultimately the MacGuffin, at the risk of mildly spoiling this for anybody who hasn't read it, about this notion of neuro-linguistic hacking. He does an excellent job of imparting that thrill of understanding a complex system. His references to Enki are, as I said in the outset, what seeded this essay in my mind, and I've been brewing on these ideas for many years. That it stuck with me in all of this time, I think, is testament to his staying power as an author to tap into this experience of grokking systems, and how Stevenson as an author is, I think, very accomplished at spreading these big ideas. Cryptonomicon, the Baroque cycle, Anathem, just increased the scale of the systems that he was dealing with. I would argue that the conclusion of Anathem in particular, again, without spoiling it, except maybe slightly, is the logical extrapolation of this theme that runs as a current throughout the rest of his books. Not surprisingly, Stevenson's hackers have to traverse a morally ambiguous world. They often evince their own internal ethic against a contravening backdrop. Knowledge of the system, sharing of that knowledge is its own reward. The Diamond Age confronts that on multiple levels. A father wants to care for his daughter, a society wants to care for its own generation of daughters, both of these serve through knowledge. Unequal factions realize that information is key to leveling the playing field. Rudy Rucker is another cyberpunk author, of whom I'm a tremendous fan, who also conveys that thrill of knowing things, knowing complex, interesting, and very often in Rucker's case, at least initially, secret things. Many of his stories revolve around unlocking that secret hidden knowledge and unpacking the consequences narratively of the unlocking. In none of his stories are the characters wholly good or wholly bad. Especially the hacker characters, usually they're scientists or, more often than not, mathematicians of some stripe. In some ways, Rucker leads the reader through to some meta-knowledge, to some higher level of knowledge, that even thinking of the original hack in those terms of good or bad isn't accurate enough, so he has to actually go beyond that initial framework with which we're familiar with through this strange, gnarly trippy story to get to a larger context to understand things at an expanded level. Many of his books dwell at length on exploring changes in systems as they unfold, and even changes in ourself and our perceptions as we go through that unfolding. And in many ways, actually, and it's not surprising that he's actually written a direct sequel to Flatland, A. Edwin Abbin's Flatland, but many of his other books are informed through similar notions of someone with more knowledge guiding an ordinary human, but one that's curious and determined, our hacker hero in this instance, trying to understand some system through a greater understanding that they could not necessarily have achieved in a lot of his stories on their own. He does a good job, too, for the most part, in tying these into personal narrative. Don't get me wrong. These are definitely very enjoyable reads, too. They're not dry treatises on systems and metasystems and gnarl and computation and so forth. But he also paints a broader mural, almost a travelogue of what some key change would wreak on the world or worlds, because some of his span multiverses at large. I find both Stevenson and Rucker immensely readable, at least partly because I find the hacker aspects of their characters so personally relatable. Of the two, I think Rucker's pacing and characters are a bit more accessible to the non-hacker. This is just the tip of the iceberg, though, drawing from my personal favorites. Other grand punks of the genre explore these themes and many more besides, like William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Undoubtedly, if you're more broadly read, and as I continue to broaden my horizons even in this genre that's one of my favorites, you'll find that these mythic tropes carry widely throughout, and that there are many other aspects of the direct experience of being a hacker in the real world reflected very clearly and very powerfully in a cogent fashion by these well-deserved and well-regarded authors in this genre. No literary genre stands still, though, and very often there are reactions to cyberpunks. The heyday of cyberpunk has passed. I think that there's even a wave in the wake of it with some of the singularity fiction, which has also kind of come and gone, and Rucker even explored that for a time. We have the rise of the postmodern hacker hero. And I think in many ways, Charlie Strauss exemplifies this latest wrinkle on the archetype. First and foremost, you have to bear in mind what I've referred to in reviewing his book, The Atrocity Archives, the wonderful essay in the appendices of that. He describes the tools of the trade of the hacker and the mentality very much gets into the driver's seat, into the heads of his protagonists. The hacker using this technology then to the same ends that others use means of strength or other attributes of skill. The change or the system or the balance that the Laundry series in particular addresses is somewhat covert. It's hidden on purpose. The balance in question here is between mankind largely ignorant of what lays out beyond their immediate knowing and the extra-dimensional beings that technology can accidentally invoke. Bob Howard, the protagonist, our hacker hero here, is called on, even coerced, to use his technical skills, his technological savvy, in serving to keep these elder horrors at bay. Knowledge is most certainly, in this series at least, a weapon, both directly in the form of, as Strauss puts it so greatly, I love this term, computational demonology, but also knowledge of the balance itself, the rules that the outer gods have to abide by. Very often those serve as critical plot points or hinges or keystones in the Laundry series that Howard has to understand in order to get by. Unlike the earlier myths, Bob's world isn't always so black and white. Often, though he acts for what he thinks is the right balance, sometimes he's left wondering. That's where the postmodernism, I think, comes in. And very much in that way, in that vein, Strauss suggests that there may be little difference between the dark elder gods and those that actually sign the paychecks for our hero, Bob Howard. In Accelerando, I think Manfred Manx is another hacker hero of great disruption. Much more Promethean, I think, in his role as the hacker archetype. Not necessarily stealing ideas or working against other agents for some greater balance, though, but rather as an inventor. His ideas, as they spring forth from his forehead as Athena did from the forehead of Zeus, cast chaos in their wake. In the third part of the book in particular, it also isn't entirely clear that the post-humans, because this is a singularity tale as well, are qualitatively better or more capable than traditional humans. Manx and his progeny act here more as openers of the way. They enable progress, often with disruption ensuing as a consequence of that process. But again, it isn't always clear that we are better off or exactly how so if we are. It doesn't change the nature, though, of the heroes in both of these works. They are still troubleshooters. They are still agents of change. There's a weird outlier I want to talk about, too. I actually, one of my favorite films that I've reviewed recently is WALL-E, and it brings forward this this curious juxtaposition, the Disneyfication of the hacker hero. One of the criticisms I read of the film was that it was overly simplified, that this trickster or hacker character upset the apple cart and left humanity wholly unable to care for itself, which would defy those kind of initial characterizations I started this piece with. At least they had a stable system before this little robot came along. Pixar actually gave a nod to this concern in the end credits, if you actually bother to watch them. They're vignettes of WALL-E and the other robots that he sort of awakens along the way, relearning the skills that they've forgotten in order to rebuild a sustainable future. The larger changes are a key part of the story, but not the point of it as I see it. More that WALL-E is an accidental hero, an inadvertent force for change, that despite himself, he wreaks these constructive changes in his wake. He pursues his own internal ethic, his drive to collect interesting things to satisfy his hacker curiosity. It's that opens up the world about him to and opens him up to the possibility of love, which is very much kind of at the core conceit, one of the primary drivers of this film. Following where that new experience leads him literally causes the rest of the film to unfold. Better yet, unknowingly, WALL-E inspires those around him to change. In the case of the robots that he encounters, to challenge and to grow beyond their programming. And in some cases, I think even for some of these characters, asks us, the audience, to reconsider our notions of what's broken or misfit. For the humans that he encounters, they are forced to realize what it is that they've lost and to reignite their own curiosity and ultimately their drive. WALL-E's trip is not without consequence, of course. There is an established force here with a stake in keeping things the way they are, like the dynamic tension between Enki, the troubleshooter god, and his brother Enlil, who's much more interested in the system as it stands. The demonization of, by and large, the corporation and its proxy in the autopilot may be a bit of an oversimplification, I'll give you that. The whole film may water things down a bit, but there are definitely present enough these elements, these attributes of the hacker story, to use that as a stepping stone. So as a geek dad, I can ask my boys questions about the chaos around WALL-E, the consequences, that nature of change, that disruption to established systems, and whether everybody involved is better off at the end. I can get them thinking about the role of curiosity, the role of the hacker, the opener of ways, and how change is affected. The last thought I want to explore with you is, where has the hacker as hero gone wrong in literature and narrative? And Frankenstein is really the easiest answer I could come up with. I'm sure there are others, and of course, if you have examples beyond this and the next one that I'll talk about, I'd be glad to hear them, and as always, share them back with everybody else. But was the good doctor a hacker hero? In some tellings, he actually is trying to redress the loss of a loved one. Subjectively, maybe he felt he was working towards some greater good. Is he working towards a greater balance, though, or is he deluding himself? Is he disguising some selfish gain in pursuing that knowledge? I don't actually think he is a hacker hero, and he may actually be an example of the mirror opposite of a hacker villain. We could perhaps typify that with selfish application of the knowledge that he gains, pursuit of curiosity despite the consequences. We talked about that disruption. I think the hacker, the hero, embraces that disruption, understands that this is part and parcel of affecting some better change, and I think the hacker villain blithely ignores it, sets it aside, or if they embrace it, it's for far more destructive purposes rather than ultimately constructive ones. Other hacker prototypes certainly had to deal with the consequences of their disruptions. Enki, Prometheus in particular, defied consequences to restore and improve balance. There is some objective measure I think we can apply from the outside of progress, some larger group gain. Frankenstein certainly exposes a risk. The hacker turned selfish and inward. So maybe he, as I said, is a dark reflection related, but his story serves a different end. I also, of course, already mentioned the Edison aids. One possibility when dealing with systems and questions of balance is that the context grows wider. What may have seemed heroic at one stage, so when the cultural mores kind of didn't question this imperialistic urge, later when we get to more of a globalistic, a multicultural, a more pluralistic view of things, in retrospect looks petty, ignorant, or in some other way kind of brutish. I think that is somewhat forgivable, even if it's not entirely excusable. In some circumstances, like with the, as I said, with the benefit of history, you know, being embedded in that situation, they didn't know any better, literally didn't know any better. They were in a process of discovering a larger world. It's tricky to treat that and think about that without being overly judgmental or overly simplistic. You have to bear in mind that progress, any kind of progress, cultural, technological, otherwise, is rarely perfectly choreographed. Discovery is messy, especially when you look back at it in hindsight. I think that's what we're seeing is some of the unintended mess that went along with trying to harness and improve steam power and lead on into the Industrial Revolution and everything that has been subsequent to that. But without risking it, far less would have been learned about herself and would have been learned to share and improve everybody's lot. It's hard to say, though, since a more considered, maybe enlightened progress might be worth it, avoiding some of the horrible mistakes that during that imperialist expansion were committed, such as, of course, the subjugation of native people. I don't think anybody's going to argue about that being pretty much an unequivocal harm in hindsight, or using newfound technologies for dire militaristic ends. I really think the best we can hope for here is also continuing to strive for balance. As long as we are realizing mistakes along the way as soon as we make them, and more importantly, learning our lessons from them, as steampunk literature has grown to be more politically sophisticated in the wake of the Edisonades, kind of realizing the mistakes of this very naive earlier iteration of that literary form, then maybe that's the price of anything but that glacial progress, that too careful approach to improving and exploring. In many ways, it mirrors the trickster aspect of the hacker. Sometimes hard lessons are invited intentionally through a trick, through chaos, through disruption, so that they are learned well, they are learned better than if we undertook things more carefully. Who's to say that going more softly would make us wiser than having the bumps and scrapes and scars of firsthand knowledge? Anyway, those are some of my thoughts. And sitting down to kind of contemplate this idea, this role in literature and film and culture of the hacker hero, as always, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are. If you have other examples to offer beyond these, other avenues for me to explore further, as always, if you share them with me, I'd be happy to share them again with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoy the program, please do go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link where you can learn how to help by making a donation, purchasing some swag, or downloading a promo to help spread the word. Of course, the simplest way to help is simply to tell a friend about the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call Listener Comment Line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night as usual, will be a news program. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DeBee for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 United States license. That means you're allowed to change and share this file as long as you share your changes, maintain attribution, and don't commercialize it without permission.